We have come to Matthew chapter 7, verses 7 through 12 in the Sermon on the Mount. And for all intents and purposes, this is the climax and the conclusion to this great sermon. That's not to say that the remaining verses in Matthew 7 are unimportant. We will be spending time looking at those in following sermons. They're very important. But the remainder of Matthew 7 forms what is essentially an epilogue to the Sermon on the Mount. And what we are looking at tonight is the conclusion to the main body of the sermon. It reaches its main conclusions here, and it begins with a very invitational kind of statement. And so we will be looking here at Matthew 7, verses 7 through 12. And to start, we'll look at verses 7 and 8. Jesus said, "Ask, and it will be given to you. Seek, and you will find. Knock, and it will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives, and the one who seeks finds, and to the one who knocks, it will be opened." As we've been looking at the Sermon on the Mount together, I've had two overriding impressions basically throughout the entire sermon. And they are that, first of all, the Sermon on the Mount is incredibly compelling, and at the same time, it is incredibly intimidating. And I'll tell you what I mean by that. As we've studied this great sermon together, I hope you've gotten the sense of the goodness of it and the wisdom of it. And as we consider Jesus' teaching that's very practical, I think we ought to feel like this is the kind of people that we want to be. We realize the inherent wisdom, the inherent goodness of Jesus' teachings. We would like to embody the righteousness of the Sermon on the Mount. I think most of us would love to live in a world that embodies the wisdom of the Sermon on the Mount. The world would be a better place if people lived by the principles that Jesus taught here. But almost everyone who reads the Sermon on the Mount honestly is also able to realize how intimidating Jesus' teaching is. It can feel very overwhelming. It describes a righteousness that is so far above us, the goals are so lofty, that you might read it and you might just think, this sounds nice, but it's not really realistic, at least not for me. That it's not really attainable or practical. And in fact, there have been some people who have read the Sermon on the Mount, and that is the conclusion that they've come to. That it sounds nice, but it's just not really realistic. It's too idealistic to be attainable. And what Jesus says is that it is something that you can have. Ask, and it will be given to you. Seek, and you will find. Knock, and it will be opened to you. That is a threefold invitation, where Jesus wants to make it clear in three different ways that this is something that you can have. This is a life that you can live. And Jesus is saying, if you want to be in the kingdom of heaven, if you want to share in its blessings, then you probably want to know what the entry requirements are. And so if you want to enter the kingdom of heaven, here is what you have to do. You have to ask. And maybe you read that and you think, surely that can't be all. Surely that can't be it. You know, for us to really enter into this glorious kingdom and to live up to the things that Jesus is calling us to live up to, there must be some other prerequisites. You know, surely we have to get our lives together first and prove our worth and prove our ability to follow Jesus before we can submit our application and be accepted. And Jesus says, no. The kingdom of heaven is not for the deserving, but for the desiring. Anybody who wants to be in the kingdom of heaven can be. And at the end of the day, that is what separates those who are inside the kingdom from those who are outside. It's the wanting to. Those who truly want the kingdom of heaven more than anything else won't let anything stand in their way. They won't let anything obscure their view. They won't let anything distract them from it. Those who truly are seeking it will find it. That's Jesus' promise. It's the wanting to that separates those who are inside from those who are outside. Now, as simple as that is, and as accessible as that is, it doesn't mean that it's easy. It doesn't mean that you can just be a part of the kingdom of heaven without putting forth any effort. In fact, there are a lot of people who think that they want to be a part of this, but in reality, they want other things more. And the decisions that they're making in life bear that out. That they might say that they want this more than anything, but the things that they're seeking in life, the doors that they're knocking on, are not the things that have to do with the kingdom of heaven. And so Jesus is saying that true, earnest sincerity, diligent pursuit, that will be characteristic of those who find their way in. In the last lesson, we talked about how Jesus warned us about casting our pearls before swine, and we defined the pearl that he was talking about as the gospel itself. Remember, we talked about that very short parable in Matthew chapter 13, verses 45 and 46, where Jesus said, "The kingdom of heaven is like a merchant in search of fine pearls, who on finding one pearl of great value, went and sold all that he had and bought it." And we talked about how that merchant was searching for fine pearls. He was somebody who had devoted his life to finding the best of the best. And it was because he was searching that he found what he was looking for. And he recognized it when he saw it. And I would imagine that most of us can relate to that. That if we are here today, it is because we have been searching for something good. And if you are in the kingdom of heaven, it's because you recognized it when you found it. The verbs that Jesus uses here, in English, they're written in present imperative tenses. Jesus is saying, ask, seek, knock. He's emphasizing that it's very important that we don't get distracted by other things. We need to be people who keep our eyes on the prize. In fact, the force of these words could be communicated something like this. Keep on asking. Keep on seeking. Keep on knocking. Jesus isn't talking about that one time that you wanted to do the will of God or that one time that you got interested in spiritual things. He's talking about the course of your life being shaped by a diligent pursuit to know God and to do His will. You have to really want it. You have to seek first the kingdom of God and His righteousness, like He said in chapter 6 and verse 33. But if you do, if this does mean more to you than anything else, you can be assured, you can be confident that the kingdom of heaven is yours. And that's an amazing blessing. That's an amazing promise. Jesus says in verse 8, "Everyone who asks receives. The one who seeks finds. To the one who knocks, it will be opened." Don't think that you're going to be the one person who sought it with all of your heart and didn't find it. You're not going to be the exception to the rule. Everyone who seeks finds. And so if Jesus says that you are welcome in, there's nobody else who can keep you out. There's nobody else who has a higher authority than the King himself. And we can have great confidence in Jesus' promise. But even more than that, Jesus reasons with us that we can have confidence in the character of God, that the kingdom of heaven will be given to us. And that's his point in the next few verses. In verse 9, he says, "Or which one of you, if his son asks him for bread, will give him a stone? Or if he asks for a fish, will give him a serpent? If you then, who are evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father who is in heaven give good things to those who ask him?" Now, I think a lot of times we read these verses and we think about how they apply to prayer, and they do apply to prayer. But Jesus is not talking about prayer per se. He's talking about a greater concept. He's talking about our relationship with God and the character of the God that we have a relationship with. It was back in chapter 6 that he talked about prayer, and he gave us the model prayer, and he encouraged us to ask for the things that we need. And so the themes are similar. But here, Jesus is talking about a more fundamental concept. He's talking about the confidence that we can have in the character of God. I think that this would be something that would be good for us to meditate on sometimes. To realize that God is on our side. He wants to bless us. He wants us to draw near to Him. He's willing and eager to give us what we need. And to really make that point, Jesus appeals to our relationship as human fathers, relationships that we might be able to relate to. I realize that I'm not perfect as a human father. You know, there are times when my kids ask me for things, and I might be a little bit annoyed by what they ask for, especially when they ask for a snack 30 minutes after we just had a meal, you know. I might get a little bit annoyed by them. I'm not perfect, but I would never dream to say, oh, you want a snack? Here you go. Here's a copperhead, you know. Jesus says in verse 11, if you then, who are evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father who is in heaven give good things to those who ask him? Jesus is reasoning from the lesser to the greater. If we think that God doesn't want to give good things to those who ask him, what does that say about our understanding of the character of God? We might be thinking about him as some kind of distant deity, far off, who's too occupied with other things to really care about us. We might be thinking about him like some temperamental ruler, but we're certainly not thinking about him as our Father. And Jesus says, when you understand that your Father in heaven is the God of the universe, then you will understand what he wants for you. And you will understand that as great as his promises are, they're promises that you can be assured of. God is not sitting on the edge of his throne, looking for an opportunity to hit you with a lightning bolt. He's not hoping that he finds a reason to condemn you to hell. He's not annoyed when we come to him in our weakness and insufficiencies. He's the father in the parable of the prodigal son, eager for his children to come home to him, looking for them with affection, and even running towards them and embracing them when they begin to make their way home. James chapter 4 and verse 8 says, draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Paul said in Acts 17 and verse 27 that God's will is that we should seek him and perhaps feel our way toward him and find him. Yet he is actually not far from each one of us. And so in the same way, Jesus is emphasizing this truth about the character of the God that we can come to know. That the kingdom of heaven is not for the deserving, it's for the desiring. It's for anyone who truly asks. Everyone who is committed to seeking it will find it, and the door is opened to all those who knock. And with that, we come to the sermon's summary statement, which we have known for centuries now as the Golden Rule. Jesus says in Matthew 7 and verse 12, so whatever you wish that others would do to you, do also to them, for this is the law and the prophets. Jesus has said a great deal in this sermon about the righteousness of the kingdom of heaven. He hasn't been bashful about talking about the commitment that will be required and the practical steps that we must take in order to submit our lives to the righteousness of God. But in Jesus' own estimation, everything that he said in this sermon about the righteousness of the kingdom of heaven can be summarized by this maxim: whatever you wish that others would do to you, do also to them. And then he adds, for this is the law and the prophets. Now, if you can remember far enough back, that should jog your memory to something that we talked about earlier. Back in Matthew chapter 5 in verse 17, Jesus said, "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them." And now, here in chapter 7 in verse 12, again, he talks about the law and the prophets. And so, this is sort of what we were talking about a few moments ago. The Sermon on the Mount has both a prologue and an epilogue. It has an introduction and a conclusion. The introduction, or the prologue, is chapter 5, verses 1 through 16, the section that we know as the Beatitudes and the Similitudes. And the epilogue, or the conclusion of it, is chapter 7, verses 13 through 27, where Jesus emphasizes the difference between the two paths and the two trees and the two foundations. But the main body of the sermon is chapter 5 and verse 17 to chapter 7 and verse 12. And these two statements about the law and the prophets form what is called an inclusio. It closes off or bookends the main body of the sermon. And as we consider the climactic summary statement here in chapter 7 and verse 12, you'll realize that the golden rule just has this indisputable ring of truth to it. I've never met anybody who read this and said, "I just don't think that makes sense." You know, almost every system of moral philosophy that human beings have ever come up with, almost every religion has very similar statements to the golden rule in it. And that shouldn't concern us. It should really strengthen our understanding that what other people have come to discover for themselves is very similar to the truth that Jesus delivered to us. You can find very similar statements to this in Jainism and Confucianism and Hinduism and Buddhism. In fact, even Judaism has its own version of it in Leviticus chapter 19 and verse 18. There it reads, "You shall not take vengeance or bear a grudge against the sons of your own people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself." But as you think about all of these similar statements to the golden rule that come from different systems of religion, different moral philosophies, the thing that all of those have in common is that they're stated in the negative. Throughout human history, people have understood that it's not right for us to do something to somebody else that we wouldn't want them to do to us. And so over and over again, statements are made like, "Don't do to others what you wouldn't want them to do to you." And though it's a subtle difference, Jesus really reveals a much more profound truth to us in the way he states it, because he states it in the positive. Jesus says, whatever you wish that others would do to you, do also to them. Jesus is not content to simply tell us, do no harm. That's only scratching the surface. And Jesus is calling us to a mission in life that is far greater than that. Jesus is telling us that we need to be actively looking for opportunities to do good. We need to be people who are looking for those who are in need and how we can respond to the situations that they're in. And as you begin to think this way, you begin to realize what a high calling that is. Because it's not enough to just do no harm. It's not enough to just sit back and say, live and let live. No, Jesus says you need to be like the Good Samaritan. That when you see somebody who's stranded on the other side of the road, that you stop what you're doing and you use your own resources to help them. And just think about all of the ways that this principle would apply to us in life. Think about how this would apply at work. When your coworker is struggling with their job responsibilities and you have the opportunity to help them out. Think about how this would apply at the grocery store or the baseball field or as you interact with other people. Think about how this would apply in church relationships. If somebody has a complaint, how would you want them to handle that complaint? Think about how this would apply in marriage. Should you do to your spouse the way your spouse would want, you would want your spouse to do to you? It would even apply in parenting, wouldn't it? How would you want your parents to treat you if the roles were reversed and you were the child? It's a very simple concept, but it's one that leaves no part of our life untouched or unchallenged. We have to think, if our roles were reversed, how would I want you to respond to me? And as simple of a concept as this is, we're really good at finding excuses not to practice it, aren't we? What if the other person doesn't deserve it? What if they don't appreciate it? What if the reason that they're in need is because of their own dumb decisions? It was their fault. Does that give us an excuse not to do to them as we would want to be done if the roles were reversed? And think about how this teaching connects to the previous section. What was it that Jesus was just talking to us about? He's just finished assuring us of the gracious character of God. He's just finished talking about how our Father's mercy and generosity hasn't been offered to us on the basis of what we deserve, but on the basis of what we need. And so surely then, we ought to deal with others in the same way. Not on the basis of what they deserve, but what they need. And so, he says, whatever you wish that others would do to you, do also to them. For this is the law and the prophets. Jesus said that the greatest commands are to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, and to love your neighbor as yourself. And when we practice the greatest commands, the golden rule will be the rule of our lives that we live by. And so, Jesus concludes the heart of the sermon just as he began, with an appeal for a righteousness that manifests itself in the purity of love. He bases his instructions for the gracious treatment of others in God's gracious treatment of us. And he calls us to a character that rests in the character of the one who made us. You know, in the Gospel of John, Jesus teaches us something about the greatness of serving others, particularly in the way that he talks about the cross. In John, Jesus constantly talks about the cross as his glory. And that would be a totally backwards way of thinking about the cross. For people in the first century, they understood the horrors of crucifixion. They saw it as something to be ashamed of, something that they would not even feel comfortable talking about openly most of the time. But as Jesus talks about the cross, he talks about it as the time when he would be glorified. And on the night when he was betrayed, he knew that that hour had come. In John chapter 13, in verse 31, it says, when he had gone out, Jesus said, now is the Son of Man glorified, and God is glorified in him. If God is glorified in him, God will also glorify him in himself and glorify him at once. Little children, yet a little while I am with you. You will seek me, and just as I said to the Jews, so now I also say to you, where I am going, you cannot come. As much as Jesus dreaded the pain of the cross, Jesus understood that the cross was the very reason he came into the world. That in order to establish the kingdom of heaven on earth, that he had to die for the sins of people like you and me. And it wasn't only that he was paying a cosmic debt that we couldn't pay. It was certainly that. But even more than that, he was giving us an example to follow. He was showing us that nothing is too lowly for the King of the kingdom of heaven. There's no act of service that is beneath him. And even the pain and humiliation of the cross would, in fact, be something that he could count as his glory. But then, based on all of that, look at what he says in verses 34 and 35. A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another. Just as I have loved you, you also are to love one another. By this, all people will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another. It's interesting there in verse 34 that Jesus says, this is a new commandment. You realize, strictly speaking, this is not a new commandment. It's not like God's people had never heard this idea that they ought to love their neighbors as themselves. In fact, we already quoted the verse where that came from. That was Leviticus chapter 19 and verse 18. It's not a new commandment to love your neighbor as yourself. The new part is that you love one another just as I have loved you. See, Jesus knew that as he went to the cross, that what he was demonstrating was the fullness of a concept that the world had never seen before. He was showing us what true love is. He was showing us the glory of sacrifice in a way that the world had never seen before. He was showing us the golden rule to its fullest extent. He was doing for us what we would have loved, what we most needed to do. He was willing to do for us what we most needed, despite the fact that we were most undeserving. And Jesus says, this will be the distinguishing mark of my people. By this, all people will know that you are my disciples. And so how do you identify the people of Jesus? How do you identify the church of Christ? Jesus doesn't say that it will be by the way that you worship or by the way that you read your Bibles. Those are important things, but those are means to an end. The end is that we become people who imitate Jesus' love for us. The world will know that we are his disciples by the way that we imitate his love for each other. And so it's with that that the Sermon on the Mount reaches its climactic conclusion. When the Sermon on the Mount has its intended effect, it will make its hearers resemble its preacher. Because Jesus' mission is to make a community of people who come to resemble himself. And so, whatever you wish that others would do to you, do also to them. For this is the law and the prophets. There may be somebody here who realizes that you have not yet entered into a relationship with Jesus. Or maybe there's something that you need to correct in your life. And if you have strayed away, then you realize that the invitation that Jesus offers in verse 7 and 8 applies to you as well. Ask, and it will be given to you. Seek, and you will find. Knock, and it will be opened to you. Even now, everyone who asks receives, and the one who seeks finds, and to the one who knocks, it will be opened. Don't let your sense of shame, don't let your sense of insufficiency keep you from the one who can make you whole and glorified. The invitation comes from the Lord. He would be eager for you to come home. And if we can help you in some way, we would invite you to come to the front and let us know how, while we stand together and sing.